host, Leah Sarah Pierre, and welcome to my podcast, Pierre Med. I'm a Canadian medical student, human rights, global health, and social justice advocate, as well as just an ordinary human being. As of March 24th, 2021, the Pierre Med podcast is an initiative affiliated with the Pierre Med Foundation, an organization started and inspired by the very beginnings of these conversations. Pierre Med's mission is serving humanity, connecting people, stories, and places. It is a platform that gives a voice to the voiceless, an ear to the helpless, and seeks to empower youth, physicians, and leaders far and wide. Today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking to Jim Sliney, the Director of Patient Outreach at Patients Rising, and an advocate for patients everywhere. He will be joining us to speak about the value of building community in chronic illness spaces for social support. Why is it that health professionals feel ill-equipped to provide patients with access to resources for social support? What value does community hold for the disabled and chronically ill? And how can we ensure that community is strengthened, even during challenging times such as the COVID-19 pandemic? If you've answered yes to any of these questions, listen as I dive into discussion with Jim and the insight he provides us with. Jim Sliney is a writer, editor, and certified medical assistant with 20-plus years of experience in healthcare and clinical research. He is the director of patient outreach at Patients Rising, where he creates opportunities for collaboration, advocacy, and research while promoting equitable access to healthcare. Jim is a Columbia University-trained writing consultant, which he leverages to help people express themselves in a variety of media. He and his wife live in the Bronx of New York City, where he'll gladly tell you the best pizza in the world can be found.
Hi, Leah. Thanks for having me here. My name is Jim. I'm the Director of Patient Outreach at Patients Rising, a nonprofit organization in the U.S. that supports patients in their quest to get access to the treatments that they need, whatever form that takes. And I've been working with patients very closely for 20 years now, both as a clinical coordinator in research studies and as a writer and director of outreach. I'm just talking with patients all the time. So this is my wheelhouse.
That's amazing, Jim. So the first question I have for you, Jim, today is, how would you describe social support, community building, and safe spaces for those with chronic illness?
Well, I like the way you worded that question, Leah, because there really are three different things. Community is a very open and vulnerable space. Okay, if take Instagram, for example, you're sharing your inner self, your outer self, with the universe without really any filters. And as a result, there's a vulnerability to that, even a risk with things like organizations that call chronic patients out for falsehoods or, you know, bullying, all types of ableism. So that's one kind of community. But there's a slightly safer community in collaborative support, where a person can join a guarded community, say like a Facebook group that you can't get in without getting past the guardians at the door. Or things like Healthline apps, or Inspire, all these gate-kept communities are a bit safer And so they tend to lend themselves to a little bit more open expression. And of course, there's even more private spaces that that groups of patients or family members can create together, where they can really express themselves without filter. And all of these play a role in a patient's ability to connect themselves with the world around them, which is really important because chronic illness can be so isolating. And so community becomes extremely important in whatever form it takes.
And so, Jim, the next question I have for you is, what makes chronic illness particularly challenging in a patient's life, and how does this affect their mental health? And as the director of patient outreach at Patient Rising, how has it been interacting with these patients?
Well, I would use the word rewarding, but it doesn't really capture how wonderful it is being able to work with people on this intimate kind of level. Mm-hmm. And it's rewarding because I get the opportunity to sort of get past some walls and have a really frank and open discussion with a patient or with entire communities of patients. The reason that that's important is because of the challenge that being chronically ill puts on a person. You can use the analogy of like a team in sports, any sport you like, but a team sort of works together, moves towards an objective with some kind of harmony. But if one member of that team suddenly can't keep up with the rest, what does that do to that team member's self-image? And what does the rest of the team think of that team member who can't keep up? There's a real world of guilt and stigma and self-doubt that comes with suddenly not being able to do the things that everyone else is doing. This is sort of the heart of disability versus ableism. So it becomes especially important to be able to create connections where you don't feel like the odd person out and where you get understood by others like yourself. Or that's why I feel so honored and privileged to be able to be a part of conversations with patients, because they're essentially opening themselves up to me in ways that they might not open to other people. And I feel really blessed to be able to be a part of that.
That's beautiful, Jim. I love the analogy that you used to put that picture together. But do you believe that social support lessens the negative emotional appraisals of the illness experience from everything that comes with it, anger, fear, hostile interpretations of illness?
I think that it can be a part of it. Having social connections alone is not like a suit of armor against all of the negativity that society pours on chronically ill and disabled people. But what it can give is something that society isn't usually very good at giving, and that is a sense of belonging. So being a part of a community, suddenly it puts you on a team of, to go back to that analogy, it puts you on a team of people with similar or at least relatable levels of skill and limitations. So suddenly you're around other people like yourself. And when you think about that, that takes away some of the stigma, at least in the community that you're participating in. The world at large is unfortunately always going to see chronically ill people as other than themselves, even though one in four people in the course of their lives is going to experience a chronic illness. If you're not in that lifestyle, if you're not living with a chronic illness, it's, I think, human nature to push away any thoughts of having to live with those kinds of limitations. So it's not a cure-all, but it really makes a difference to be able to share thoughts with other people who get you. I hope that answers that question.
Yes, that answers the question, definitely. And I do agree that it is a part of the process about the way that social support can help a person emotionally, physically, mentally, just to know that there's this other person out there that relates to you on a level that maybe your family doesn't or your friends don't, but that there's this other being out there that understands and has gone through the same experiences, I think can be really beneficial to the patient or the person suffering with a chronic illness. And so, Jim, this question I have for you is more from the clinician point of view, is should clinicians encourage their patients to seek social and emotional support? And why is a strong support system, both at the time of diagnosis and throughout the period of a chronic illness treatment, important?
Well, to address the first part of your question, yes, absolutely. Clinicians should be encouraging their patients to join chronic illness communities or communities of like persons. The reason for that is I think we all know that when you go to see your doctor, time is limited. So they don't really have the time, even if they do have the inclination, and I think many providers do, they just don't have the time to be able to help build the sort of muscles and support that a community can provide to a patient. So I think of it as sort of a companion to seeking healthcare from a provider is to seek support from a community. And I would love to see providers having say a specialist in gastroenterology, rheumatology, should have a list of patient support organizations at the ready, so that when they see a person with, say, inflammatory bowel disease, they can point them towards established organizations that are already built and in place to give the patient that extra support that the provider can't. I think that's really important. I think all providers should be doing something along those lines. As for the importance of having that support system, both at diagnosis through treatment and onward, there's really two different kinds of support that the patient needs in those different times. When you're first diagnosed, it's scary. And there's a lot of unknown. So there's a sense of loneliness that comes with that too, because when you first learn that you're diagnosed with positional orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, for instance, you're probably not going to know anyone in your social circles who has this. So understanding that it's not just you as soon as possible can help prevent the development of negative mindsets for yourself, for the patient. And also educating oneself on the nuances of the specific diagnosis takes away a lot of the mystery and fear that comes with a fresh diagnosis. One of the advocates I work with, Rachel Westlake, she's a patient advocate and counselor for young people with cancer. And basically the song she sings to her people is, come, let's learn together. Let's erase a lot of these fears and the boogeymen that come as soon as you hear the word cancer. It's a horrifying word. But there are ways to dispel it through community and education and empowerment. And that doesn't really stop over the course of living with a chronic disease. 20 years later, there's still learning to be done because innovations are happening. So in that regard, I think it's important once you're in a community to stay connected to it, because that's how you're going to learn about research studies or new treatments that are in development, about conferences. Now that, well, maybe now that we can all see each other in person sometime in the near future, I hope, please. But that's how you stay connected. And that connection is what keeps you strong over the very long journey of your chronic illness.
And Jim, you just brought two questions that I've not written down on the sheet, but one of them is, do you feel that clinicians should enter these safe spaces or these patient groups to speak with patients, or should they just take the stance of the provider, the clinician in the clinic or hospital, and not step beyond it?
Okay. First of all, pardon me, I'm in New York City, so occasionally we're going to have sirens. But I would definitely say that clinicians should, when invited, participate in these communities. Not all communities want to have providers there because then they have to be guarded about what they say and how they express themselves, right? But the very first patient conference I ever attended was for the Hypoparathyroidism Association back in 2000 something or other, a long time ago. Let's just leave it at that. And what was wonderful about it was that patients came from around the country, as did their caregivers and family members and doctors, nurses. So everyone across the entire spectrum, from patient to provider and everything in the middle, were there. And the conversation was electric, and it was really healing for a lot of people. They learned things that they could never have learned in a year of talking just amongst themselves. So I think there's really something to be said for opening the door to have providers, scientists, all different kinds of experts present to be a part of those communities. But cautionary point, again, when invited, it's really up to the patient community to decide when they're ready for that.
Absolutely. And then the next question I had from you is that, seeing how important connection is, how important community is and safe spaces for patients, what effect do you think COVID-19 has had on these relationships, these bonding and times that are extremely crucial to patients?
Well, it's really hard to overstate how difficult COVID-19 has been for the chronic illness community. A community that began before COVID ever reared its head, much of the chronic illness community already lived a relatively isolated lifestyle. People, for instance, with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, you're probably not going to see them at many, you know, concerts or dance halls and the like. So chronic illness patients are often politely declining invitations to a lot of social events. So they're already kind of isolated. And then COVID came in and doubled down on that isolation. And that was really difficult. The people I talked to, I talked to a lot of people really suffering with that. But challenges like that breed solutions. And one of those solutions was, I think, the great expansion of the chronic illness voices into social platforms like Instagram and TikTok. You know, when I first went to TikTok, it was all just like people doing silly dances and fart jokes. But now it's full of people expressing, in very creative ways, I might add, the challenges of living with chronic illness And I think by using such a mixed platform, their chronic illness patients are able to communicate the complexities of being chronically ill to people who would never have encountered those kinds of thoughts and ideas. So in a sense, a new form of expression has grown out of this terrible isolation. And I've met more people since COVID began than I did before, because Zoom opened up conversations with people all over the world. And so while no one would ever want a COVID type event to happen, it really has made some things possible that I think felt impossible before, or at least weren't imagined before.
100%. I definitely do agree. COVID-19 has breathed innovation and creativity, and yeah, in the most difficult times that we've had to live in, I think this was it's definitely shaped the way that life is now. That the pre-COVID world is not going to be the same post COVID-19. And I think these Zoom is here to stay, especially because it facilitates communications, conversations halfway across the globe, beyond time or distance. So I think that's extremely valuable. Just like you're in New York City, but I'm in Montreal, and I'm exactly able to have a conversation with you. So
I think that's pretty great. Yeah.
So Jim, my third question for you is, what are some ways patients listening can use to cope with chronic illness?
Well, there are a few things that I would recommend or suggest. If someone that in my family I knew and loved suddenly was diagnosed with something very serious and that isolated them, I mean, one of the first things I would do for sure is tell them to find your people. Your people are out there. Other people who are experiencing the things that you have, the fear of diagnosis, the uncertainty of understanding your disease, not knowing what treatments or the side effects of them might be. There are people who've been through those journeys or are in different parts of the journey. So it's really good to connect with those people. And they're easy to find. You could literally go to any search engine, type in the name of your disease, add the plus sign, and write patient support organization, and you'll find these different groups. If you want to do it especially locally, throw your like zip code in there so that it'll search just locally. But they're there, I guarantee it. The other thing you want to do is educate yourself from the experts. One of the worst things that social media has done for our society is the spread of opinion in the disguise of fact. All right. So, and that can be really dangerous, obviously. No need to give examples about vaccines and things like that. I think we all know what I'm talking about. So I would suggest any person diagnosed with a chronic illness, go to the most reliable sources you can think of, the National Library of Medicine, NIH. I'm sorry, I don't know what the Canadian equivalents of these are, but you know, there's the public research arm of the government is really good at putting together up-to-date, reliable information. And so I would definitely encourage somebody to educate themselves from the experts. Also, like the clinical societies for gastroenterology, cardiology, things like that. They often have digestible information. And if you're running into information that seems over your head, don't feel bad about that. It's over most people's heads. It takes a lot of work to become a PhD. And once you get there, you like to talk in language that other people don't understand anymore. So find the people who are talking your language, but also have behind them the legitimacy of these established organizations. Thirdly, I'd say it's important to be able to express yourself. The psychologist James Pennebaker coined the term expressive writing. And now I'm a writer and editor by trade. So I may be a little biased here, but I feel like keeping a destroyable journal is a great way to get things out of your head and out of your heart and onto something else. And then you can destroy it, burn it in a very safe, controlled way, whatever you want to do, but get it out of your head. And it doesn't have to be writing, though. It could be art. It could be music. Just express these feelings that are staying bottled up inside you, because there are a lot of feelings that come with becoming chronically sick. And don't leave them trapped inside you. I think that's maybe one of the most harmful parts of chronic illness, is what it does to your self-image and your confidence. And lastly, and this is something I probably wouldn't have recommended 10 years ago, but I've actually seen in a lot of rare disease communities, patients who get out of frustration and understandable frustration, they get, they lose their relationship with their doctors, and they sort of blame their doctors for not being able to find answers. And I think that kind of relationship is not productive. It's understandable, but it's not productive. So I would tell any patient to nurture their relationship with their provider, because really you're on the same team trying to achieve the same things. Sure, you have different considerations, you know, time, money, whatever, but doctors are our best allies in the quest to improve our lives with chronic illness. So those would be my recommendations to somebody freshly diagnosed, or someone who's been on the road for a long time and frustrated and just doesn't know where to turn. Rebuild your relationships and educate yourself.
Beautifully put, Jim. And this kind of goes into the next question, is that why is it that those with chronic illnesses, why are they left behind when it comes to research? Is it a lack of funding? Is it sexism? Is it racism, or is it just the view that the lives of the chronically ill are not valuable?
That's a tough question, man. let me do my best here. First, I should say that I come with some background in clinical research myself, with building protocols, recruiting for them, and so forth, clinical trials and the like. And first, I want to say perhaps the least popular response, which is scientific rigor plays a big part in this. When investigators develop a protocol to test a drug or treatment or diagnostic tool, they have to have controls. Variables are the enemy of science. They're perfectly reasonable and real, of course. But when you're trying to make a determination about the effectiveness and safety of a specific drug, the last thing you want are a bunch of unknowable elements that can skew your results. So from a very practical perspective, it takes a lot of extra work to allow for all these variables. And Many of the most frustrating chronic illness communities are ones that are poorly understood. Now, of course, the catch-22 here is, if they're poorly understood, well, don't we have to research them more? And we can't research them more because they're poorly understood? Well, that's definitely a hurdle we have to figure out how to get around. And I think that's a role that nonprofits can play. And I think, for instance, that researchers who are doing clinical trials should always partner with patient support organizations so that they can also do the wellness and lifestyle understanding of their cohorts that traditional clinical research has overlooked. But as far as ableism, well, yeah. Ableism, sexism, racism, these are all real problems and they cannot be underestimated. But these are often issues that are easy to for researchers to fall back on, I think in part because they think that understanding these others who are not themselves would take so much more work. And this might actually limit their access to funding, their ability to get published. It's just, it's hard, you know, but yeah, we know it's hard. Do the hard thing. And it's worthwhile. So there's a lot to overcome in research. And I think I think researchers need to look more holistically at the populations that are being researched. It's very easy, of course, if you're doing a sickle cell disease study, to look at Black people because it's more common in their community. But it also exists in other races. So we have to be prepared to open those doors to let more people in, and don't be afraid of these differences. Embrace them because that's where discovery happens. And so that's my challenge to all researchers listening to this podcast. Don't be afraid of the unknown. Embrace it because that's where your best papers are going to come from.
Absolutely, Jim. Well done with putting that together. And so the next question I have for you is, why is there a trust gap in healthcare, especially for BIPOC patients and those with more than one chronic illness? Often we hear about, or I'm sure on Instagram, you've heard patients complain about how their physicians or providers have misdiagnosed them. So, this creates a trust gap where they don't take their provider seriously, the provider doesn't take the patient seriously. So why is there this trust gap that exists in healthcare?
I think that trust gap, it comes down to fearing the steps necessary to develop trust, right? That trust comes from vulnerability and authenticity and frankness. Something that a provider may not have time for or sufficient healthy ego to embrace, right? So patients go to their doctor and feel like they're getting some canned response or something that's that they don't know the motives behind a suggestion, recommendation, right? So I think there needs to be a lot of transparency, and patients and doctors need to be prepared to have more open, vulnerable conversations. Now, the challenge to making that a reality is time. So this comes back to a point we touched on earlier, and that is providers should be partnering with patient support organizations to provide that transparency and authenticity that all patients need to feel like they're in a two-way relationship that they can really benefit from. Because a patient is never going to be honest with their doctor if they feel like they're going to be judged for their honesty. We all do, hey, if we were all honest with our doctors, our outcomes would probably be very different. Because right now there's just a lot of things people don't want to say. I work closely with Melody Blackwell at The Color of Crohn's and Chronic Illness. And their mission is essentially to engage people of color with inflammatory bowel disease and other chronic illnesses. And one of the challenges that she and I have talked about the most is that people of color don't see themselves in their providers. So hardly an easy solution, but there just needs to be more people of color in medical school. There needs to be more ability to connect socially as well. There's no reason why a church group or a local organization can't bridge some gap between a chronic illness community and a patient support organization. And that patient support organization can say, well, we've worked closely with this group of providers, and we can say with certainty that they get what you're going through. And so we have to think outside of the doctor-patient relationship and think more widely, socially, universally, about how we can build the connections that lead to trust and faith and openness. And I think once we do that, we'll have much better outcomes in the end.
Absolutely, Jim. Like just this weekend, the Peer Medical Foundation, we hosted a workshop that is decolonizing dermatology. And at this workshop, it was basically taking providers and students on a journey going over different diseases from Kawasaki to eczema to dermatitis herpetiformis, showing them the contrast that comes with people of color versus those that are white. In that workshop, we went through a journey of how race can affect your provider-physician kind of relationship with your patient. And we provided some resources and tools for patients to access the, how to go about accessing healthcare, how to speak to their provider, where to look at images for people of color on the internet, where they can get their information. So I definitely do believe that education, that bridge needs to be built between patients, providers, and the community, because we each have an extremely important role to play when it comes to bettering healthcare overall.
That is so right, Leah. And I think the Peer Med Foundation does fantastic work doing that. Building those connections is really important, and it doesn't always come naturally. So having the courage to insert yourself into a conversation or into a relationship where you can make a difference really makes a big difference. And I thumbs up, two thumbs up, the Peer Med Foundation for the work that they do to make that possible.
Thank you so much, Jim, for that. It really means the world to hear that from you, especially. But what can we do better to serve and meet the needs of patients who often feel dismissed or not listened to? From my perspective, what I often tell my colleagues or providers when they feel that patients are not feeling dismissed or listened to, I always tell them, just sit down with your patient. Take a minute to just sit down and like forget the rest of the environment and see them as a human being in front of you. Listen to them. Ask them, what are their concerns? How can you make their life easier? But in your opinion, Jim, what can we do better to serve these patients?
I think any foundation or nonprofit whose mission is to serve patients has to do more of what you were just alluding to, and that is have just conversations. It doesn't have to be a conversation about somebody's disease. But I want to hear, for Patients Rising, when I reach out to patients, my first question is not, what's your diagnosis? Or have you seen your doctor lately? It's, how are you? I mean, what's nagging at you that you need to talk about right now? Because chronic illness isn't just an illness. It's an entire way of living, you know? And I think there needs to be more sort of like cookout mentality. Hey, let's just get together and have like a chat over some iced tea or whatever. And let's talk about the stuff that's on our minds. Why I can't, you know, go out with my friends and how that makes me feel and what is something I can do about it. Because in the presence of community, there are many answers to the problems that we all encounter. But it's not even just about finding answers. It's about also being able to express these things that are inside you and to be heard in a non-judgmental and not performative way, but in a real, just like, hey, I want to be your friend. Let's be buds. You know, what's going on? what music are you listening to right now? And how is it hitting you? You know, just be people. You know, I think that's the next step in the evolution of chronic illness communities making connections. Like we talked about earlier, COVID maybe locked people indoors, and then social media stepped in and opened doors. So what are the next doors to open? Okay, well, all right, we're dancing on TikTok, right? We're doing the dum 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 dum, whatever the heck people are doing. I'm a little too old, sorry. but okay, what comes after that? I think what comes after that is just like vulnerable chats. You know, whenever I'm speaking with a group of patients, I always remember one of my first most meaningful conversations with like fellow students when I was in college. We got together at a bar, we nursed a beer each, and we talked for like 4 hours. What did we talk about? I don't know, but we just did. Those are the kinds of environments we need to recreate somehow with our communities, because then we all just feel like people again, not sick people, but people, you know?
100%. I definitely believe we do need to recreate those environments. And this goes into the next question, which is, why is it important to keep up these social support networks for those with chronic illness? And what value is there fundamentally in building this community?
Well, one of the things I learned early on in my own life is that let's put this from the perspective of a caregiver for the moment. When someone in your life becomes chronically ill, your expectations for the future change. This is why I think a lot of relationships and marriages end up falling apart when somebody gets a chronic illness, because suddenly all the plans you had for the future have to be rethought. And so maybe my life arc and my partner's life arc are different. I'm very happy to say that my wife and I have overcome the hurdles of chronic illness together, in part just by really being open and honest with each other, having those hard conversations. So the reason why staying connected to a community over time as a chronic illness patient, and one of the things that's hardest to do, by the way, is when you're feeling good, you're like, oh, okay, I don't need the community anymore. I can just go be, you know, the me that I thought I was going to be. That's a perfectly normal and natural response. But I would encourage people to resist that response and stay connected to the community, because your sudden wellness or period of recovery might give hope to other people in that community. But that connection is important to maintain over the full course of someone's disease, your entire life, if you're chronically ill, because life has seasons, and the seasons of your life will change how chronic illness impacts you. And why not go through those changes with other people who are going through them as well? One real concrete example, going back to the hypoparathyroidism community I worked with, the people who were not participating in the patient community were not aware of research opportunities that the people who were involved in community were. And so some people had access to drugs through research like 10 years before the drug was ever approved. And so they had, you know, 10 years of improved quality of life that people who are not engaged in the community didn't know were even possible until much later. That's just an example of how when you're not in the community, sometimes you can miss out on important things. You might not know about that that live get-together that's going to happen in Walla Walla, Washington or something, or over in the Bronx. You know, you might miss out on things like that. So being in the community helps in so many ways, so many times over time, that the benefits are inarguable as far as I'm concerned. But I need to add that to chronic illness patients who feel somewhat troubled by their community, I also understand that. You don't want to be defined by your illness. And sometimes by staying engaged in the community, you can start to feel like, okay, everything about me is all about, you know, this disease that has been visited upon me. So you also have to have interests outside of your community. You know, if you want to paint, paint. Join a painter's community. That doesn't have anything to do with chronic illness, maybe. But yeah, so I just wanted to say that for the people out there who have trouble staying in their chronic illness community for a long period of time. I get that. I understand that too.
Absolutely. And so then, Jin, what about those that are too afraid to come out and share their story, or even are not comfortable speaking to a group of people that share the same illness? For example, there was this patient who, because she had a speech impediment, she did not want to seek support. So what advice do you have for these patients?
Well, those are real identity concerns. No one wants to feel judged, especially if you join a group of people who are supposed to understand you better than any other group of people. If you become ostracized in that community, it could be doubly hurtful. So I would say that the benefits of community are still important to an individual like that, so they could seek them in other ways. Take a class or an online class in art or drawing, or take a writing workshop, and you find that you can start to connect with people based on what you are comfortable expressing. You know, a lot of the chronic illness patients that I've met, I didn't meet in medical settings. I met them in writing workshops that had nothing to do with chronic illness. But when they decided to write, they wrote about their illness. And so we made connections that way. And the point of saying that is simply to say that any kind of personal expression where you can feel safe, regardless of what community it is, could be a good place for you to express those important things. And maybe they will lead in baby steps to a community that you can truly trust. I know that at Patients Rising, you know, we've made a very concerted effort to address the more recent awareness of diversity, equity, and inclusion issues, because we didn't want people feeling left on the outside. So we put a council together, and they look at everything that we produce, and they share their thoughts and ideas with us to make sure that we're using the language that makes people feel included, because it's really important to sincerely set a stage where everyone feels like they can come up and sing their own song. That's not easy, but it's a challenge worth tackling for sure.
That's great, Jim. I think equity, diversity, inclusion work is needed in all sectors, be that in the healthcare field and education in the workplace. It's extremely important, and I'm so happy to hear that Patients Rising is taking that seriously. And so the last question I have for you today, Jim, before I let you go, is that with increased life expectancy, the aging of society, advances in medical care, it's naturally estimated that the population of individuals with chronic conditions will continue to increase. So what can we do to ensure safe spaces for these individuals, and to ultimately lessen the financial burden that comes with chronic illness?
Okay, I feel like I've just been asked to solve world hunger. the idea that comes to me in response to that is that I think social platforms need to be built by the chronic illness communities for the chronic illness communities. So that you're not visiting someone else's platform to express yourself, you're actually living in your own society built from within. It's sort of like the utopian concept where everyone is an equitable stakeholder in the well-being of society. And I think that when people are living longer and more people are being successfully diagnosed, that there's going to be all the more need for micro communities, and no one's going to understand those communities better than the people already living in them. So I foresee in the coming years more platforms things like Facebook may finally fade away, which wouldn't be a horrible thing, I guess. But that new things will take its place that speak in the language of your illness and your experience, because it's coming from people who are like you, people who look like you, sound like you, and have similar experiences. I think that's the future. Communities for communities by those communities. And I'm hoping Patients Rising gets to have a real role to play in that, because in our own small family, we have our own chronic illnesses and caregiving roles. And we want to empower any group to be able to create their own homestead, little camp where they can get together and just be themselves. We can help build the platform, but they should do all the work. I mean, because that's how it feels owned by the community.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jim, for this conversation, for going on and speaking about the different aspects of building community, about safe spaces for those with chronic illness. Thank you so much for coming on.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for this, Leah. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to the PMed podcast. It means the world to have a supportive audience from 50 plus countries and counting. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to stay updated. Feel free to share it with friends and family members. More importantly, please follow Patients Rising. The platform aims to highlight patients and to give them a platform and a place to share their story. For further information, follow us on social media, or email us at PureMedFoundation@gmail.com. We here at PureMed are excited to bring you new content, stories, and conversations, week in and week out. We cannot wait to see our new and familiar faces here back each episode. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe, stay healthy.